The Emperor of the East was no longer guided by the wisdom and authority of his elder brother, whose death happened towards the end of the preceding year. And as the distressful situation of the Goths required an instant and peremptory decision, he was deprived of the favorite resources of feeble and timid minds who consider the use of dilatory and ambiguous measures as the most admirable efforts of consummate prudence. As long as the same passions and interests subsist among mankind, the questions of war and peace, of justice and policy, which were debated in the councils of antiquity, will frequently present themselves as the subject of modern deliberation. In his colossal Decline and Fall of the Roman Empire, 18th-century historian Edward Gibbon cites weak leadership as one of the causes of the collapse of the most powerful state in the ancient world. But what other forces enabled 5th-century Gauls, Visigoths, and Vandals to penetrate the heart of the empire and sack Rome? I'm Norman Gilliland.
And I'm Emily Auerbach. This is University of the Air.
Why did the Roman Empire stop growing? What role did Christianity play in bringing the empire down? And how did its fall affect Europe? Our guest is Mark Kleivecht, professor of history at the UW-Madison.
Welcome to University of the Air.
Thank you very much, Emily, and thank you, Norman.
Well, let's start with the idea of the fall of Rome itself. I mean, did the Romans know they were falling?
No, absolutely not. I don't think we call it an event, and we put a date to it, 476 AD. But in the Roman world, there is no conceptualization, no realization, no acknowledgement that their empire has now come to an end. That can only be established in hindsight. In fact, just to elaborate on that a little bit, we know that the destruction of Rome, or the plundering of Rome in 410 by the Goths and the plundering by the Vandals in 455 actually left a much more prominent mark on society at the time. Everybody was up in arms about that. Christians had to defend themselves that they were not responsible for those particular acts. 476 was simply ignored in complete silence.
Why do we call 476 the fall of Rome then?
I think it has to do with the fact that we're looking back in time and we think this is the moment when the last Roman emperor was deposed, taken to a villa in Misenum. His name, ironically speaking, was Romulus Augustulus. So Romulus, the founder of the Roman Empire, and Augustus, the second founder. And this was a 12-year-old boy, little Augustus, and basically an incompetent emperor, because how much can you do at the age of 12? And he was not replaced with another Roman, but the German general who deposed him basically put himself in his place and started to rule as king.
What did Rome look like at its height, and what was the high water mark for the Roman Empire?
The Roman Empire started to grow already in the 3rd century BC, when it had its epic struggles with Carthage, Phoenicians, the Punic Wars, as we call them nowadays. When they won those wars, they had established themselves as a power in the western part of the Mediterranean. They started to become involved in the final part of the 3rd century BC in all sorts of internal struggles in Greece. And from there, their empire grew until in the 1st century BC with Julius Caesar and Pompey. It slowly but surely became the largest empire that the world had ever seen up until that time.
Stretching how far?
All the way, and then we move a little bit further in time. We are now in the 1st century AD under the Emperor Claudius, who invaded Britain just to show that he was a military conqueror, just like other emperors. So all the way from Britain in the northwest to the Sahara in the south, in Africa, a large stretch of land along the tip of the African continent was entirely Roman. It was fertile. It was highly productive in terms of olive oil and wheat and wine. We move further east, where we move into Syria for a short while at the beginning of the 2nd century AD. That included modern Iran as well. And then we move back into continental Europe, and we're in southern Germany. So this is a massive empire, which later in European history is occupied by several European states.
I guess I'm trying to visualize this huge area that's calling itself the Roman Empire in an era without easy communication. You know, how did the people even know that they still were in the Roman Empire? I mean, how unified a bloc was this?
Well, I think it depends on who you ask. I think the Roman authorities knew exactly where the boundaries were, and they constructed roads along which they put miliaria, so therefore mileposts that indicate how far you were in distance from any Roman town or any Roman settlement. But I think it's in certain places it's fairly common to that the border between the Roman Empire and what is not the Roman Empire is very fluid. Unless you go to areas which are heavily defended by Roman armies, because
Hadrian's Wall would be another example.
Hadrian's Wall, but we've got different defense systems in the east. We have them in North Africa, not as prominent as Hadrian's Wall. But those are the areas, yes, southern Germany also comes to mind. This is where you've got a fortress or at least a guard post every 100 yards, and you cannot simply cross into territory. But talking about Hadrian's Wall, writing tablets have been found in one of the forts alongside Hadrian's Wall called Vindolanda, which is now Hausteads along Hadrian's Wall. And some of these and they found writing tablets there and scratched on wood. So we can still read those, although with difficulty. And they make mention of places which are obviously located to the north of Hadrian's Wall.
So they had actually gone up into, like, Scotland.
Absolutely.
On forays.
There may not have been permanent settlements, but at least there were temporary outposts there. And it's not warfare all the time. I imagine when the Picts or the Scots are threatening, these people would actually move back behind Hadrian's Wall again and be in safe territory. But it's I think, incorrect to think of this sort of defensive system that the Romans had implemented as a means to not make any traffic between the two regions possible. It's a fluid boundary in most times.
And why were the Romans able to have such an enormous empire? What gave them their power?
If you ask the Romans themselves, when they talk about this, it's the fact that they get along so well with their gods. The Pax Deorum. They do everything right. If they make a mistake, they have to redo a particular sacrifice, a particular religious activity in order to get the approval of the gods. And when they are being defeated, it's a definite sign from the heavens that this was not their victory. And they have had really epic defeats as well. We tend to forget that. We tend to focus on the fact that this is an enormous army that has enormous manpower, is well organized, has formed a kind of strategy or multiple strategies that helped them to become victorious on the battlefield, fighting against Germans and Celts who are basically disorganized for a long time of their history, and therefore they become so victorious.
And the Romans had technology on their side too.
In a way, yeah, if you compare them to the Germans and the Celts. But if they had to fight the Parthians in the east, that was a completely different matter because they were as superior in technique and technology and civilization as the Romans. And the cataphracts, the horses that wear armor, are an Iranian Persian invention. So they had the wherewithal and the power and the techniques to basically defeat the Roman army.
And where was the drive coming? In other words, was it part of their religious ideology to spread the word or to expand? You know, because we think more in modern terms of, or more recent terms of manifest destiny or, you know, burdens where you have to spread your good system to others. Did the Romans think, you know, here we are with our arches and our colosseums and our aqueducts and we owe it to the world to spread these things? Or was it just greed?
I think that would be peculiar to, let's say, the 19th century and Victorian imperialism. The Romans, basically, they tell themselves a story and they tell the stories to others as well, that they were never intent on conquering territory, or at least not in all cases in which they became involved. It's usually a story of they're being invited by friends to help out against a common enemy, and then they do so. They stay around for a little while, and then they move all their troops out. Until, and this is the 2nd century BC, they have to decide that they're going to stay. So maybe if there is a sort of watershed moment in the history of the Roman Empire, it's that 2nd century BC when they've tried all sorts of different ways of controlling states and avoiding warfare on an annual scale. And then all of a sudden things change. They destroy Carthage and Corinth in the same year, 146 BC, and then they basically make provinces wherever they go.
And they were also, though, very generous, if that's the word to use, with their infrastructure. In other words, they would build roads, they would build aqueducts, they would build all kinds of civic improvements.
Well, those roads are not necessarily for the benefit of the provincial population.
Yeah, that's why I say, if that's the word to use. Yes.
Yeah, they usually built in order to make it possible for armies to travel through certain territory as quickly as possible. And when you see the huge aqueducts outside of Italy, and for instance in southern France, the Pont du Gard, you've got them in Asia Minor, which is modern Turkey, quite a lot. Those have been mostly put up with local money. Every city in the Roman Empire is ruled by a small oligarchy, mostly of not more than 100, 150, but in the East it could be 200, 300 individuals, who are in the habit of using their own money or their family's money in order to sponsor public construction. Not for the entire 100%, for the rest, well, let's say 50%, and 50% comes from taxes. So if you go to a particular former province of the Roman Empire, let's say in Tunisia or Algeria, you see lots of aqueducts, you see temples. Chances are that most of these buildings have been put up not by the central government in Rome, but by local people who want to become Roman, be accepted as Romans, and become Roman citizens.
You mentioned taxes. As long as you've mentioned taxes, I suppose the most famous instance of taxation is in biblical terms, you know, when Joseph and Mary go to pay their taxes as citizens of a Roman province.
Yeah.
What would their tax money have gone for?
That money was completely used for the upkeep of Roman institutions, so therefore the army in most cases.
So it really wasn't staying at home so much. It was helping to finance the occupation.
Absolutely, yeah. It the whole idea, and I'm seeing that from time to time in books, that the Romans actually put up constructions, helped to civilize the people in the provinces. Those are exceptional moments in Roman history. I know of one or two cases where provincial governors are actually represented by authors as setting up schools, building temples, etc., etc. Agricola, who's the father-in-law of the historian Tacitus, is one such provincial governor. But it's not the systematic policy of the Roman government. The whole idea was to use a big carrot, and that carrot was Roman citizenship, and to allow elites, not the masses, but presumably only the elites, to become Roman citizens and to help in ruling this empire with the Romans.
Can you say something about the hierarchy, you know, the split between the elites you just mentioned and the peasants, the slaves, and so on? I mean, I think the image many of us have of the Roman Empire is of the people at the top taking very luxurious baths, having a very lavish lifestyle, but built on the sweat and blood of those on the bottom.
Yeah, and to a certain degree, of course, like any stereotypes, that's true. That's true. I usually tell my students that the minimum requirement for being a member of the Senate, which is the highest political institution in the Roman Empire, somewhere between 600 and 900 people, it varies from what part of Roman history you're looking at. They have a minimum requirement of 1 million sesterces. Now, to translate it into contemporary terms and contemporary coinage, that's a little bit difficult. So I always tell my students, a soldier gets an annual salary of about 1,000 sesterces. So can you imagine this is so many more times the annual salary of a soldier.
1,000 times, yeah.
And that is simply their minimum requirement. There are senators who've got 200 million or 300 million sesterces.
So it is government by the wealthy. It's a
Absolutely.
It's a plutocracy.
Absolutely, yeah.
And it's totally centered in Rome at this point. We hear about, you know, the Eastern Empire and how that lasted another 1,000 years.
Mm-hmm.
As if we're looking at Rome in the from the 2nd century B.C. to about the 1st century A.D., are we talking about two centers of government, or is it all from Rome?
It's all in Rome, and it's, particularly in the 2nd century A.D., even Greek writers, who are normally very, well, you can't call them patriotic or nationalist, because that's the wrong term. They love their culture, and they want, most of them want nothing to do with the Romans. There's a cultural movement in the 2nd century AD in the Eastern Mediterranean that's called the Second Sophistic. The people who are part of that are highly educated. They speak as in public. They realize that they're part of this political reality in which Rome is the dominant party. But they're acutely aware of the fact that they are far more superior to the Romans in terms of intellect, in terms of education, in terms of all kinds of disciplines. But even they refer to Rome as the city where anything and everything can be found, because it's all imported there. This is the most important city in the Roman Empire, close to 1 million inhabitants, which is only surpassed by London and Paris at the around 1800, 1810s, 1820s. So the usual question with Rome is, is it so big because it lives on what you can call robbery capitalism? This is another term that Max Weber coined, which is basically you impose taxes on the rest of the empire, which means that the city of Rome doesn't have to work and doesn't have to do a lot of things in order to keep up its wealth. The reality is a little bit more complicated than that. But to a certain point, that particular judgment is true. So Rome is the city of cities. It is politically the most important entity in this Roman Empire.
And how widespread is slavery at this time?
You don't find slavery everywhere, but it's particularly prominent in Italy, where perhaps some people have estimated as many as 15 or as much as 15 or 20 or 30% perhaps of the population is servile. You see it also in southern France. You see it in the east, the eastern provinces as well. But there are large tracts of provinces where there is no slavery, or where we have very little information about slavery.
And who got to be slaves? I mean, was it partly ethnic? Was it certain groups that were enslaved?
Anybody who was not Roman. So they don't discriminate on the basis of skin color or anything else. Anybody who was not Roman is good enough to be a slave. That sounds a little bit cynical, but maybe from a Roman perspective, where Cicero in the first century BC actually explains that it's good to rule over all other people. It's just a good thing. There's nothing wrong with absolute power over anybody else in the Mediterranean. So that means that anybody could become a slave. There are even people who, and this is basically a different trend within slavery, people actually volunteered to become slaves. Because as slaves, you sometimes have a better future, or at least the expectation that you can have a better future. Because the Romans are in the habit of manumitting their slaves with great frequency. And if you do that in the correct procedure, that means your slave becomes a Roman citizen overnight. If you are yourself a Roman citizen, you free your slave, you go through the right procedure in front of a magistrate, that slave is a Roman citizen.
What kind of rights would a Roman citizen have under the empire? I would assume it would be somewhat different under the republic, but under the empire, what's the difference?
If you're a Roman citizen, first of all, you're being judged according to Roman law. And that could be beneficial in a number of ways. I think the symbolism of being a Roman citizen is much greater than the practical or pragmatic benefits that you can reap with that. It's not like you're paying lower taxes. Or even it was the custom since 167 BC when Rome acquired Greece. Well, they defeated a king of Macedonia and then decided to keep Greece for themselves. From that moment onwards, nobody who had land in Italy had to pay taxes on that. So you can say as a conclusion here that a lot of people living in Italy had a stake in the empire because it actually freed them from all sorts of tax obligations. However, if those Roman citizens acquired land in Roman provinces, they had to pay taxes on it, even though they were Roman citizens and they didn't pay taxes at home. So it's more, can you call that egalitarian in a way? It's basically whether you're Roman or non-Roman, you pay taxes at the same level. So it's sort of fair.
We're going to look more at the Roman Empire and why it fell when we continue in a moment with University of the Year.
I'm Norman Gilliland, back with Emily Auerbach and our guest, Mark Kleiwicht, and we're looking at the possible causes for the fall of the Roman Empire. We started, Mark, with this concept of barbarians, as I guess the Romans would have called them, these people with beards, for example, coming into Rome and essentially looting. And this at a time when Rome presumably didn't have such a army as it had a couple of hundred years previously. How did it all start unraveling so that these Vandals and Visigoths and Goths could come right into the empire like that?
I have to point to a couple of things that are happening in the meantime, because I think previously we discussed the formation of the Roman Empire. We talked about 2nd century BC, 1st century BC, and extended that into the 1st and 2nd century AD. What we see at the beginning of the 5th century is that Rome is no longer the superpower that it used to be. And there are very credible reasons for that particular situation or that circumstance to come about. First of all, the Germans that they are fighting in the 5th century and other people, including the Huns and etc., are not like the Germans that they fought in the first century AD and could easily defeat. those were small-scale tribes. And when I say small-scale, bands of warriors, that's what I mean. And they basically on the move all the time, living like nomads. Even if they have a blood relationship with another German tribe, they could easily fight them the next day. So these Germans are basically woefully disorganized. They depart from very primitive military strategies. And it's easy for the Romans in the first century AD to actually play them out against one another or to defeat them sequentially, one by one. They don't pose that much of a threat. Look, the Romans are still being defeated when they don't act cautiously enough. They lose three legions in 9 AD because of a couple of mistakes that they make on the battlefield. A big disaster for Rome at the time. But something like that only happens once in a century. So what we need to look at when we move into the later Roman Empire, we need to be aware of the fact that those Germans are far more better organized in the 3rd century and in the 4th century, in the sort of build-up to the final days of the Roman Empire, in the West at least. All these small bands of warriors are now reassembled in huge peoples, huge German tribes. Maybe tribal association is not even the correct term at that time anymore. They've become far more civilized. They've learned from their opponents. And they are much better opponents now than they were in the first century AD. And then if we look on the inside and we look at what the Roman Empire is doing, then we also see that for whatever reason, it becomes much more difficult to defend the Roman Empire. For instance, all these defensive systems that we talked about before turn out to be rather useless. If you actually have a whole stretch of frontier or border that is defended by walls and by guard posts and so on, you actually hope that this is a system which was invented to keep out the small bands of warriors. But how can you keep out 100,000 Germans that are actually attacking at one specific place in the wall? You need to have an army of 100,000 there. And what the Romans have done instead, they've spread out their soldiers all along the frontier. And at some point they realize that this goes in the wrong direction.
They're outmoded, actually. Yeah.
Absolutely. And they try to have a much more mobile army, which is pulled back from those defense systems. But even that doesn't help them enough. So we have several instances in the 3rd century where those defenses are being breached and huge troops of soldiers, German warriors, actually enter into the Roman Empire.
And what are these German soldiers that are entering the Roman Empire out to get? Is it booty? Is it
everything? But, I mean, they can lay their hands on. Yeah.
But they're not at that point trying to take over Rome. They're just trying to plunder.
They're trying to plunder. Yep. And I think initially it may have been their idea that at some point they want to go back. I think initially there are a couple of invasions where the tribes actually, or the peoples, do return to their native territory. In some cases, they stick around for a little while. And that becomes the standard over time. In 406, this is a crucial year, which is very close to the first sacking of Rome in 410 by the Goths. The defensive system is breached once again. And this time, the Germans will never leave. So that's basically the end of it. And they do so in the West rather than in the East. There are a couple of very good reasons for that. But I first want to, before I start talking about that, I first want to illustrate that it's also a matter of organizational skills on the Roman side that are particularly reduced compared to the first century AD. I'm talking about Roman emperors and how they should organize their empire, how they should be in control. In fact, between the 235 and 284, there are probably more emperors around than at any other time in the Roman Empire.
Going through a succession of short emperor reigns.
Absolutely. Some of them never even make it to Rome. They rule for 30 days, they rule for a couple of months, then they're dead on the battlefield.
Instability.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And that doesn't help an empire.
How much power was vested in those emperors? I mean, how much did it matter who was at the very top?
Being a Roman emperor actually requires a lot of human resource skills, and they need to persuade people to cooperate with them. First of all, the political entities in Rome, the people, the soldiers of the Praetorian Guard, and the Senate. If you lose their loyalty, then you're not going to stay in power for a very long time. So with the onset of warfare, there comes, with all these Germans invading, there comes a different criterion, and that is how well can you actually act as a military strategist? How good are you? Can you appoint the right kind of generals to take care of us? And it's exactly in that 3rd century that you see a couple of parts of the Roman Empire, because of weak emperors or ineffective emperors, that they succeed for a while. For an entire period in the 3rd century, Britain, Gaul, and Spain are not part of the Roman Empire. They have their own emperor, who is a local guy who can take care of business much better than the emperor who's in Rome and too far away. At some point, they find a solution for that where you've got a system with two senior emperors and two junior emperors, and they spread out across the entirety of the Roman Empire. But that leads to problems of succession, because sons are being excluded from this system. And at one point at the beginning of the... Well, at one point in the Roman Empire, there are as many as... It's the time of Constantine. There are as many as 8 or 9 emperors at the same time. Not in succession, but at the same time. They all claim to be emperors, and they all want to be sole ruler.
And the emperor, you mentioned, Mark, appoints the generals?
Yep.
Rather than them rising up through the ranks on merit?
Well, that happens as well, but it's usually a good emperor actually keeps an eye on what is happening in the armies. And there are different armies located in different parts of the Roman Empire, of course. Traditionally, it was the case that senators were the only ones who could lead armies into battle. And that system turns out to be ineffective at the moment when the greatest crisis is at hand. So in that same 3rd century, which is perhaps essential for the later history of the Roman Empire, because it dented their self-esteem, etc., etc. But in that period, Roman senators are permanently excluded from any sort of military command. And it's the second status group in that society, the equestrians or Roman knights, who are much more professional soldiers, and some of them have come up through the ranks, that are now in control of military commands.
What about the presence of Christians and how that enters into the story of the Roman Empire and its fall?
Well, there has been a long-standing theory. I don't think anybody at this point in time believes in it, but in the 18th century, 19th century, it was particularly fashionable to point to Christianity as one of the causes for the internal weakening of the Roman Empire.
Edward Gibbon was one subscriber to that theory.
Yeah. Well, the idea is that when Constantine converted to Christianity, and however we think about this conversion, it is quite clear from all the evidence that after 312, there are certain privileges for the Christian church, there are privileges for Christian leaders, etc., etc. More and more people are exempted from all sorts of important burdens. And especially at the time when the crisis is already starting to mount, any group that is privileged enough to be excluded from the heavy lifting in that society is going to be pointed out, especially by later scholars, as one more burden that this empire cannot carry.
And this, despite the fact that we're getting taxes from the provinces?
Well, but if let's say, keep in mind what I just said about Britain and France and Spain not being part of the Roman Empire. If they have their own emperors, that actually means no taxes from those areas come to Rome as well. So it's little bits and pieces and sometimes small parts of the Roman Empire that are permanently under the control of others, also Romans, but those taxes do not go to Rome. So just at a time when Rome needed all the money that she could muster in order to put up a fighting chance against those barbarians,
she wasn't getting it.
She wasn't getting that money.
Was that also an issue in terms of the loyalty of the military when you get them off in one of these far-flung provinces with some other authority other than the emperor in Rome? Do things tend to fall apart a little bit that way?
I think in most cases, soldiers then will develop some sort of loyalty of their own. It could be that entire armies are actually turning away from the Roman emperor and decide to no longer support Rome. In the later Roman Empire in Britain, for instance, there are a couple of legions who hardly ever listen to what Rome has to say. There's somebody there on the ground who tells them what to do.
I've seen discussion of the Roman Empire and its fall in terms of its moral decay, implying that Roman citizens were moving away from a sense of virtue, that they were engaged in practices that were, in a sense, barbaric or savage or hedonistic, and that there was a sort of moral decline that led to its fall.
You don't think Caligula was morally upright?
Maybe according to his own sort of spectrum of morality.
But
we
use that term barbarian now to apply it to the people sacking Rome, yet there are barbaric practices that the Romans are engaging in. So I guess can you talk about some of the savagery, some of the human sacrifice, some of the practices from within that historians might look to now as problematic?
Well, human sacrifice didn't occur in the Roman Empire committed by Romans. When it is there, it's done by Druids and it's done by Celts in France. And the Roman Empire, at the beginning of the first century AD, does its utmost in order to root out that kind of practice. They also do that in North Africa, where you have a god, Saturn, that requires child sacrifices. So I think overall, but I'm biased, of course, being a Roman historian, the moral decay of the Romans, I find that a problematic issue, because we're using modern terms in order to define what is morally wrong and what is morally right. And of course, we're entitled to do that. But whether that's historically accurate, that's another matter.
So what happened in the Colosseum, for example? How would you?
Well, Let me first give you the Roman explanation, and then I'll give you my modern perspective on things. Nobody will actually say that this is a good thing. But what the Romans did and what the Romans were thinking was they trained prisoners of war or volunteers, because there were volunteers as well, in the arts of fighting. And these have to fight as gladiators when you sign up as a gladiator or when you're allocated to a training school. You become a slave and you're the owner of a lanista, which is the owner of a gladiatorial troop, and then you fight. But the idea is to see, and I'm sort of paraphrasing now famous Roman authors like Seneca and Pliny the Younger, to see virtue in action, even exhibited, displayed by somebody who is a slave. So it's about the act of fighting and the art of fighting, and that could actually be displayed to everybody in the audience by people who they considered legally inferior. So maybe it's a little bit too easy to say that is an explanation that we can live with, but that's the Roman perspective. They see it as an art form, and I think we have many references to bloodthirsty people who want to see people die in the arena. Not all of those voices have to do with gladiators. There are also executions in the amphitheater. It's much more concerned with that. Gladiators are quite well respected amongst the Roman populace for their skills, and the only one who are being basically booed at are the ones who do not fight well.
Was the combat to the death in the Colosseum?
Sometimes. That depends on the rules that were actually agreed upon. You can fight what the Romans called ad digitum, to the finger, which basically means you have to lift your right index finger at the time when you think you're injured and you cannot go on, and then you ask for mercy, and then that's usually the end of the fight. So other fights where there is an agreement beforehand that every fight is going to be to the death of one of the opponents.
What about persecution of the Christians and others?
Well, of course, that happens, but it's not a consistent policy. If you look at the Roman Empire in terms of persecutions of Christians and how far-reaching those were, we see them under Nero. The next time we see them is in France in 177 under Marcus Aurelius, the philosopher on the throne. And then we enter the 3rd century when we have a massive wave of persecutions. But for long stretches of time in the Roman history, there are no persecutions.
How significant were the slave revolts in terms of being a threat to the Roman Empire?
There are 3 slave wars or slave revolts, and they all take place in the 2nd century BC and the 1st century BC. So there are 2 on Sicily and 1 in Italy. Spartacus is involved in the 3rd one. That's in the 70s BC. After that, there are no more slave wars and slave revolts, or not massive revolts. We don't know why. We can point to a number of different factors that may have played a role. For instance, the fact that most of the slaves that revolted on Sicily came from the same linguistic background, came from the same region, had been captured as prisoners of war only fairly recently. I think from that moment onwards, the Romans decided never to do that again and to actually mix nationalities. So no more wars or slave wars after 72 BC. That's when Spartacus is defeated. But that doesn't mean that the Romans do not have a fear of slave revolts. It becomes and remains a persistent element in their mentality, that there could always be an outbreak of slaves, and slaves could never be trusted. Even the most loyal ones could certainly turn around, etc., etc.
We're going to look more at the fall of the Roman Empire when we continue in a moment with the University of the Air. The decline of Rome was the natural and inevitable effect of immoderate greatness. Prosperity ripened the principle of decay. The cause of destruction multiplied with the extent of the conquest, and as soon as time or accident removed the artificial supports, the stupendous fabric yielded to the pressure of its own weight. The story of the ruin is simple and obvious, and instead of inquiring why the Roman Empire was destroyed, we should rather be surprised that it subsisted for so long. That's from Gibbon's Decline and Fall of the Roman Empire. I'm Emily Auerbach, back with Norman Gilliland, and our guest is Mark Kleivecht, and we're talking about why did the Roman Empire fall. I'm guessing that you probably wouldn't agree with Gibbon that the story of the ruin is simple and obvious. Nothing seems to be simple and obvious in history.
No, but I've got great respect for Gibbon. He was very perceptive, and what he said there was to the point. I'd like to make things a little bit more complex and complicated, because things as difficult as or things as momentous as the fall of the Roman Empire can never be explained by pointing to one factor or even two or three. I usually compare it to the Industrial Revolution. We know that it happened. We know more or less when it happened, but it's very difficult to pinpoint exactly what caused it. You can single out three or four important factors, but that's not the complete explanation for why the Industrial Revolution came about. And I think the same is the case for the fall of the Roman Empire. You can point to internal weakening. You can point to, well, some people say that the Roman Empire didn't fall, it was murdered, and murdered by these Germans, of course. So every generation has its own interpretation of the fall of the Roman Empire, why it ran out of energy, lead poisoning, depopulation, simply a lack of spirit. The Romans of the 5th century were not the same as the Romans of the 1st century, an inferior sort of Romans. Now, I find that too flat.
What do you think? What's your version?
I think it is a combination, obviously, of a number of factors. What I think is wrong with the Roman Empire is that it always lags behind. It's so big, it's so massive, that it cannot make changes quickly enough. And when your opponent is going through a process of quickly adapting to changing circumstances, the Romans, well, they're bound to defeat the Romans at some point. It's hard to keep that many bees or that many animals out of your barn if you have a particular area to defend, but everybody wants to get in. How do you do that? And it was a matter of still inferior civilizations, when I talk about the Germans, but vastly improving, fighting against an empire that was very sophisticated, but maybe a little bit lethargic and maybe a little bit too complacent about itself. Although I'm saying that too complacent, but that's something that we cannot actually find in the sources. We have to read that into the sources.
Right, it would be a hard thing to expect somebody to express overtly. What about theories that the Roman Empire, in a sense, lost its way or its sense of identity by this very fact or this very act of bringing in all these disparate populations into Rome?
Well, that is a theory that has been very popular at the beginning of the 20th century, funnily enough, but strikingly so. I can imagine if you actually combine it with all sorts of contemporary political and socioeconomic developments. But there were quite a few people, even outside of continental Europe and in the U.S., that is, who believe that the Romans actually dug their own grave by actually incorporating in positions of high power and high responsibilities people who were clearly so much more inferior than they were. And that has to do with the fact that most people who teach ancient history, but especially at the beginning of the 20th century, were people who firmly believed in the ideals of Roman civilization. Maybe they went to a high school where they were taught Greek or Latin. That's basically the epitome of their civilization. For a long time, of course, that was how it was regarded. The sort of most excellent form of education was by immersing yourself into the classics, to read Plato, etc., etc. So for them, and we see the same with people who talk about slavery and so on. For them, it was unthinkable that those very people who built up this magnificent empire would have been responsible for its fall. And therefore, that couldn't be the case. And it needed to be somebody else. Mm-hmm. And those people they found, some of them actually pointed to all these slaves of Greek origins, of Syrian origins, or perhaps even worse, completely uncivilized places that ended up in Rome, were treated as slaves for 30 years, but then were freed, all of a sudden found themselves in the possession of Roman citizenship. And in combination with the theory that the Romans didn't reproduce themselves biologically, you get an overwhelming majority of foreigners who do not exude the traditional virtues of what it is to be Roman.
If we accept the idea that history repeats itself, which you may not agree with, but if we do, then how would you see the fall of the Roman Empire and the Roman Empire itself as having an impact on the thinking in terms of the British Empire, the Third Reich, or even America today? How has it shaped our concept of empire itself?
I think a lot of people nowadays are looking back at the Roman Empire from that particular perspective. We shouldn't repeat the mistakes that they were making, depending on what kind of theory they have about the fall of the Roman Empire. And since I don't want myself to be pinpointed with one particular factor or even one particular set of factors, I find it hard to say this is the lesson we can learn from this, or we should rephrase that and perhaps say we can look at the fall of the Roman Empire and see how unique its fall was compared to the fall of other empires. I don't think there's any instructional value from studying the Roman Empire and say, okay, the Romans did this and therefore we should guard against that.
You gave us the Roman take on gladiatorial games. You haven't yet given us the contemporary take on them. As we look back at them, how do you evaluate them?
Well, I think the gladiatorial games can be explained from a Roman perspective much better than they can from a modern perspective, because they're distasteful to us. And therefore, I always condemn, not so much in writing, but when I talk about gladiators, I say, well, this is, of course, unacceptable, but what do we gain by actually condemning the Romans to a kind of behavior that we find unacceptable? By calling it unacceptable, we make it much harder for us to understand them. So I'm sort of oscillating between those two views. I'm well aware of the fact that as a modern person living in the 21st century, to have a certain appeal coming from individuals killing one another is distasteful and therefore should be condemned. The Romans did it, and the explanation that I gave just now for their behavior was good enough for them. I think we should look at gladiators with those two views in mind. If we use the one and not the other, then we're going to blind ourselves to so many things about the Roman Empire.
Final question for you. What fascinates you most about looking at this period of the fall of Rome?
I'm mostly interested in people and how people actually construct their lives. I'm researching lower-class people more than upper-class people. It used to be the other way around. Lower-class people is much more challenging to find something about the mentality of slaves, how they think, how they see their lives in a society where there is virtually no evidence for how slaves actually thought, unless it is filtered through the lens of an upper-class aristocrat who could write. This is a society where maybe not more than 5 or 10% of the population could read and write. So I'm making life difficult for myself, but that makes it more interesting. I think if we simply focus on that 1% of the Roman population that belongs to the elite and leave it at that, we actually make a lot of misconceptions and misperceptions about what it is to live in the Roman Empire in any given century. What is interesting is to have those various dimensions. What does a worker think? What must his life have been like? What was it like to be a woman in the Roman Empire? And not necessarily a woman of the upper classes, but a woman of the lower classes.
Well, we'll look forward to hearing what you find out from those other voices, those underrepresented voices of ancient Rome. Our guest has been Mark Kleivecht. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you very much for listening to me.
I'm Norman Gilliland with Emily Auerbach, and I hope you'll join us for the next hour of University of the Air.